He was sworn in as the 45th president of the U.S. just about 1 year ago. President Donald Trump delivered his inauguration address at the Capitol, laying out his vision for the country and the next 4 years.
What truly matters is not which party controls our government, but whether our government is controlled by the people. January 20th, 2017 will be remembered as the day the people became the rulers of this nation again.
Examining the history of past presidents' first year in office provides a helpful perspective on the current Oval Office, and we'll get that perspective this hour. Michael Nelson is the Fulmer Professor of Political Science at Rhodes College. He's also a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, which specializes in presidential scholarship. He's an editor of the new book, Crucible, The President's First Year, and author of Trump's First Year. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kate.
A good entry point to this conversation might be to start with this question that comes up as a thread through a number of essays in Crucible. The question is, what time is it? Explain where we're at in this political time.
Well, one way of answering that question is that Donald Trump was compared with most of his 44 predecessors as president, was very fortunate in taking office when he did, which is worth noting because during the campaign and even in that inaugural address, he described the country as being in desperate straits, almost on the brink of Armageddon. But the truth is that unlike Abraham Lincoln, he didn't have to deal with a secession of seven states before he even took office. Unlike Franklin Roosevelt and Barack Obama, he didn't have to deal with a massive financial crisis. In fact, there were no crises on the world stage or the national stage when he took office a year ago today. The economy was steadily, slowly but steadily growing, inflation low, unemployment low. And unlike most of his recent Republican predecessors, he took office as a Republican president with a Republican Congress. So he was dealt a very, very good hand 1 year ago today.
So we're hearing much stability coming into office. Reflect on what this first year has been like for the president.
Well, it sure has been interesting. And take that as either, you know, a positive or a negative. We wake up every day, as I think he does, wondering what he's going to say today or tweet today. And by the way, that's been a remarkable innovation in presidential communication, which he's handled very, very effectively from a political standpoint. He's a president who didn't know much about the history of the office or of the country or much about the Constitution when he became president. You would expect that he, even more than most predecessors, would have learned a lot just by doing the job over the course of the year. But the truth is, this is a 71-year-old man who's been, certainly by his own lights, successful at everything he's done in the business world, in the celebrity world, in the political world. And the truth is, I don't think he's ever felt a sense of, I need to learn how to be a good president. By understanding what my predecessors have had to deal with and how they dealt with it.
Michael Nelson, President Trump has said on a number of occasions that deals are his art form. How is he doing in the art of the deal in the Oval Office?
Well, you know, dealing in the world that he came up in, which is the world of Manhattan real estate. And that is a kind of a cutthroat world where walking away from a deal is not considered to be unusual. It is in the world of Washington, where your word is your bond, where he could, if something didn't go his way with a contractor or a lender, he could very easily find another contractor or another lender, maybe not even pay the ones he'd originally contracted with, and get away with that. And in Washington, there's one Congress you have to deal with. You can't get frustrated with Congress and say, well, I'll find another one that I like better. So I have a feeling that his sense of being a dealer, a deal maker, I should say, which, by the way, even people who studied his business career don't think he's as great at it as he thinks he does. But transposing that kind of deal-making experience into the world of the American constitutional system of government, it's not a direct translation. And I'm not sure he really understands that. We're seeing today, of course, the latest iteration of the shutdown possibility born of the budget crisis. And one thing that people in Washington have had a hard time figuring out is, what does President Trump want? Because from minute to minute, it seems like he's interested in finding a solution for the immigration question. And at other times, he says, no, not unless you do this, that, or the other thing. And at other times, so my point is that this is somebody who I think learned how to make deals in a very fluid, cutthroat, you know, tough guy sort of system. And that doesn't really transpose well into the challenges faced by a president.
Michael Nelson is with us. He's a professor of political science at Rhodes College. He's also a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. He is editor of the new book, Crucible, The President's First Year, and author of Trump's First Year, which is out today. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think can be learned or taken away from a president's first year? Which president do you have seen an excellent first year? What about a difficult first year? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michael, the presidency is not defined by campaign promises, but sudden crises that pop up. That's one of the takeaways from one of the essays in Crucible. What have been some of the crises that President Trump has had to take on?
Well, to be honest, there have been no crises that he has had to take on. He has generated some crises. You know, for years, the North Korean government has shown this consistency in just posting outrageous accounts and charges against the United States in inflammatory language. That's kind of what they do. No previous president has thought, oh, I need to respond in the same sort of playground taunting way, until this president. Obviously, the little rocket man, the fire and fury language that's come out of the president's voice has escalated has long been a difficult relationship with North Korea into potentially a serious crisis. And to me, it's fascinating. This is, on a lighter note, one of the statements out of the North Korean government accused President Trump of being an old lunatic, to which he responded by objecting to the fact that they called him old. Other than that, the economy, and this is an economy that for the most part he inherited, I don't doubt that his tax cut bill and deregulation of business has added fuel to the economy this year. And credit him with that. But pretty much we've had a relatively peaceful year, both at home and in the world, except for having a president of the United States who likes to stir things up. This is somebody who I think wakes up in the morning and watches cable news programs, cable morning talk shows, and whatever he reacts to goes straight from that reaction to his right index finger to his phone and then out there into the world. And the rest of the day, commentators and reporters are responding to those tweets and other political things. It's like every day he wakes up and says, well, what can I do to keep things interesting today?
It has been a year since President Trump was sworn in as the 45th president. So what has his first year been like? How does his first year compare to other presidents? We're exploring these questions with Michael Nelson. He's a political science professor at Rhodes College and a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. He's editor of the new book, Crucible, The President's First Year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How would you assess the president's first year? Should a president's first year be compared with his predecessors or evaluated on its own merit? Perhaps it should be a combination of both. Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll be back after a news update. On January 20th, 2017, President Trump took the oath of office and delivered an inaugural speech that is remembered mostly for being dark.
And the crime, and the gangs, and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
Depending on who you're talking to, President Trump's first year in office has been either the, quote, best first year in the history of all U.S. presidents or the polar opposite of that. How did past presidents inform what we can glean from President Trump's first year? Presidential scholar Michael Nelson stays with us. He's edited the new collection of essays, Crucible, The President's First Year, and his new book out today, in fact, is called Trump's First Year. Your thoughts on the first year at 800-642-1234. Does the record of a president's rookie year tell us anything about the next 3 years? Should we compare President Trump to the past? Join in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Justin now, who joins us from Oshkosh. Hi, Justin.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just had a real quick point. I'm kind of middle of the ground here, but, you know, I haven't heard a Republican or a Democrat say, hey, the problem here is that we're spending more money than what we're making. We, you know, at my house, when we run out of money, we don't sit here and say, how can we borrow more money? How can we, you know, go further into debt? We say, where can we cut back?
Justin, thanks for the observation. Michael Nelson, how is that translated into President Trump's first year?
Well, you know, President Trump, like his recent predecessors, took office with the government spending hundreds of billions of dollars more than it takes in each year. But that isn't something, and Justin is right about this, that isn't something that's really been on the agenda for the past year, either on Capitol Hill or in the White House. Instead, we had a massive tax cut for corporations, for individuals, and the assumption seems to be that we can spend a lot more money than we take in. And because so many investors around the world are willing to lend us that money to finance that debt, we'll be fine. And to be honest, we have been for the most part. In other words, Justin is right. If a family tried to live way beyond its means, it would be in trouble. But a family doesn't get to print money. Now, I'll point out something that's coming up very soon as part of the early second year that the president is facing. Congress at various times has set a maximum figure on the national debt. The national debt is basically all the deficits we've run for the last 230 years added together. And it is now approaching $20 trillion total debt. But the debt ceiling that Congress has legislated is about $1 trillion less than that. And sometime early in this year, probably in March, Congress is going to have to decide whether to raise that debt ceiling or not. And when that happens, it's usually an occasion because a vote has to take place in both the House and the Senate. It's usually an occasion to force those in government to at least have to address the question of how much deficit spending is enough, how much is too much, how much debt is tolerable, how much is not, what needs to be cut in the way of spending or raised in the way of taxes. So looking ahead, you know, to the coming year, I would say that within a month or certainly no more than 2 months, that's going to be something that Congress and the president have to deal with, because the law requires that they can only borrow so much more than they are allowed to under the law unless they change the law.
Michael Nelson, how have executive orders shaped the president's first year, and compare that to history?
This is an interesting and distinctive thing about the Trump presidency. Not that he's issued a lot of executive orders, but because so did President George W. Bush, so did President Barack Obama, but rather that he sort of hit the deck running as a new president. You know, I mentioned Bush and Obama. In their case, they spent the first few years of their administrations trying to get their policies enacted through laws passed by Congress. And that's what typically presidents do, because if you get a law passed by Congress, then it's on the books, and no subsequent president can undo it with an executive order of his own. But President Trump seems to have decided, even with a Republican Congress, to go to that executive order strategy from the get-go. And I'm sure from his standpoint, as somebody who came out of that sector of the business world in which the boss was the boss, issuing executive orders just seemed like an ordinary thing to do. But the truth is that an executive order, as I said, can be undone by the courts if they think it's arbitrary. It can be undone by a subsequent president with another executive order. And so in going that route as heavily as he has, he's been able to get some things accomplished, but they are sort of fragile accomplishments, because in a constitutional system of government, courts can weigh in and Congress can weigh in and subsequent presidents can weigh in.
You also write that some of the executive orders are very small things, like the changing of a name of a Tennessee courthouse.
Yes. You know, Trump has looked for occasions to brag about his accomplishments are bigger and better than anybody else's in history. And during the campaign in 2016, he said it was a problem that Obama issued so many executive orders. He thought that was, you know, off the beaten path. But within a few weeks of his becoming president, he started bragging that he had issued more executive orders than any of his predecessors. Well, numerically, that may or may not be accurate. But when you look at what the content of some of those orders were, you know, appointing a new trustee to the Smithsonian Institution is an executive order, but it really doesn't amount to much in terms of the lives of the American people.
Three branches of government are supposed to provide the necessary checks and balances, and we learn this at a young age in civics class. When a president's ambition seems to be misguided, is the system working?
Well, I think, you know, that to me, because a lot of people are very, very alarmed by what they consider to be a sort of out-of-control president. You can have your own opinion about that, but I think one thing we can take assurance from, and there's a lot of evidence for this in the past year, is that we've got 230 years under a Constitution that takes the power of government and slices and dices it among three branches in Washington and between that government in Washington and the state governments. And by the way, through the First Amendment, slices and dices it further so that there is a free press and people have the right to organize and march and protest. And I think we've seen over the course of the past year just how resilient that constitutional system is. Federal courts have undone certain actions by the president. Congress, even though it's controlled by the Republicans, has not rolled over and played dead. And the people, certainly, at the grassroots, are intensely organized. The latest example of that being the second round of women's marches just over this past weekend. So I think one thing President Trump has done is show us that we have lots of ways of taking the authority that's distributed under the Constitution and using it in a way to put up certain barriers to what a president might try to do on his own.
We're examining the anniversary of President Trump's first year in office, taking a look back at his first year, as well as a comparison to history with presidential scholar Michael Nelson. He is a political science professor at Rhodes College. He edited the new book, Crucible, The President's First Year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think a president's first year in office is critical, or should we step back and give a president more time, more space before drawing conclusions? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Michael, President Jimmy Carter was in a position where he didn't reach out and make solid relationships with congressional members, with Congress, didn't answer their phone calls, really kind of put up a wall in those relationships. What did we learn from the Carter presidency that we can carry over to the Trump presidency?
Well, the Carter presidency, his election as president, for starters, really marks a kind of landmark in our political history over the last three-quarters of a century. And bear with me as I sketch this out a little bit, because in the aftermath of World War II, we went through a period of 25 or 30 years where almost all our presidents, we elected almost all our presidents from the talent pool of people who had experience in government in Washington. So Harry Truman, as a senator or a vice president or both. So you think about Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, all of them Washington figures. Well, not surprised that we trusted the federal government back then. It was the government that led the Depression and won World War II. But then along come Vietnam and Watergate, and people start losing confidence in Washington. And they turn in 1976, for the first time in quite a few years, to somebody whose basic position was, I've had experience in government, but I'm not part of that mess in Washington. And starting with Carter in 76, we start electing governors as president, right? Carter, Reagan, Clinton, George W. Bush. Now, these are people who have experience in government, but it seems like Americans were saying, we want experience in government, but we don't want it to be part of that Washington mess. Well, and by the way, Trump, I think, is sort of the next iteration of that evolution, where he has no experience in Washington and no experience in government. But Carter is interesting because he takes office, he feels very confident as somebody who's been a chief executive of a state, that he knows how to run a government. And what he finds out is that the experience he had in Georgia dealing with a part-time legislature and so on really didn't transpose well into the Washington setting. I think with most presidents, it's the things they think they know, the things they think they're confident about, based on previous experience, but often get them into trouble. And Carter was an example of that. He didn't feel like he needed to learn anything about how to deal with Washington because he had dealt with Atlanta. Well, it turned out he was wrong.
President Clinton had to build his reputation with world powers, had to show that he could govern because he had come from Arkansas, a smaller state, if you will. What about a president's first year and how they conduct themselves on the world stage?
Well, Bill Clinton was elected in 1992, basically by saying, you know, the incumbent president whom I'm running against, George Bush, spends too much time dealing with world affairs, which, of course, was the end of the Cold War and the first Gulf War. I mean, it was major business. But Clinton basically got elected in 1992 by saying, I'll be a president who doesn't focus on the rest of the world, who focuses on our country. And what he learned by being president and although in maybe his personal conduct, Bill Clinton didn't learn a whole lot about how to behave, but he certainly learned a lot in his professional conduct. And one of the things he learned is that, first of all, if you're president of the United States, you have to deal with the rest of the world. And he also learned, and I thought this was fascinating, that sometimes making unpopular decisions on the international scene, and you think about his policies toward Haiti and Mexico and Bosnia and so on, he realized that I can make unpopular decisions on the world stage that are tough decisions, and one by one, Americans may not like them, but when they add it all up, they will realize that I'm a president they can trust. He said, you know, what I found out is that it's sort of like a kid going to the dentist. No kid ever wants to go to the dentist, but at some point, every kid realizes, I'm glad my parents made me go to the dentist. It was painful, but I realized it was good for me. And so Clinton learned from experience, A, that dealing on the international stage was essential, but also that the American people would respect him for doing that. And I think by the time he left office, he was one of the most engaged and admired foreign policy presidents certainly in our recent history.
What about surrounding yourself with advisors who know Washington and the initial months in the presidency where they're staffing up? What have we learned in the Trump presidency and, again, looking back through history?
Well, it's crucial. If you're somebody who doesn't have deep personal experience in Washington, dealing with the wide range of institutions and actors, if you're somebody like these governors who've been elected president or Donald Trump, our current president, one thing you have to realize, and by the way, nobody got this better right away than Ronald Reagan, is that you need to bring in people who know how Washington works. Now, to some degree, Trump did this with his choice of a vice president. Mike Pence is somebody who was a member of the House of Representatives and rose to a leadership position and extremely well-wired in Washington. And I think Pence has been a very valuable advisor to President Trump. But otherwise, he sort of did what he had done as a businessman. He sort of stocked the White House with family members, with people he who he knew had a sense of deep personal loyalty to him rather than competence at doing the job. And we saw more turnover in the White House staff over the past year than in any recent administration, because people just haven't been working out. And with the exception of General Kelly, whom he brought in as chief of staff and who really does seem to know what he's doing, and General McMaster, whom he brought in as national security advisor, I don't know that the Trump White House has gotten a whole lot better at helping this president to navigate the very difficult environment.
The anniversary of President Trump's inauguration was Saturday. We're taking a look back at his first year in office with presidential scholar Michael Nelson. He's a political science professor at Rhodes College. He edited the new book, Crucible, The President's First Year. Author of the new book as well, Trump's First Year. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think a president's first year in office is critical, or should we step back and give a president more time before drawing conclusions? How would you conclude the first year has been for the Trump presidency? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back after a news update. President Trump ended his first year in office Saturday with the lowest approval rating of any prior president. That's according to Gallup's weekly polling data. Let's hear a bit more from the inaugural address on January 20th, 2017.
We will build new roads and highways and bridges and airports and tunnels and railways all across our wonderful nation. We will get our people off of welfare and back to work, rebuilding our country with American hands and American labor.
According to the Associated Press, the president has spent more time with his approval rating below 40% than any prior first-year president. We're getting analysis on the first year in office with presidential scholar Michael Nelson. He's a political scientist at Rhodes College. His new book out today is Trump's First Year. He also edited Crucible, the President's First Year. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. How would you characterize President Trump's first year in office? What do you remember most? How would you summarize it in a few words? Does the record of a president's first year tell us anything about the next 3 years? Join in or email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Nelson, where we paused in the conversation was in the relationship a president has with his vice president. How important is it for a vice president to have a clearly defined vision for the job, and how the vice president's staffers can relate to and mesh with a president's staff?
That's a great question. You know, the vice presidency for many, many years was regarded as just kind of a joke office because it was. Vice presidents were marginalized. And, this is the second time we're going to talk about Jimmy Carter in this hour. One of the things he did with his vice president, Walter Mondale from your neighboring state of Minnesota, Carter a governor, Mondale a senator, and Carter said, I want you to be a different kind of vice president, and Mondale was totally on board for this. I want you to be part of everything I do. I want you to be in all my meetings. I want you to see all the papers that come across my desk, and I want you to be free from any sort of particular assignments so that you can be a wide-ranging advisor to me on all the things that I have to decide on. And I want you to have a professional staff of people who can give you the kind of information that you need so you can give me good advice. And that really transformed the office, that Carter-Mondale experience. And it carried over when George Bush became Ronald Reagan's vice president and Dan Quayle became George Bush's vice president and Gore and Clinton and Cheney. And it's carried over into this administration. So Mike Pence really has inherited all the transformation in the vice presidency that has occurred over the last 40 years. And he's also, like other vice presidents, extremely loyal, certainly in public, to the president. But the fact that he's over there in a very sensitive part of the world now, at a very sensitive time in Jerusalem today, I think is an indication of how much the president trusts him to represent the United States well. And I'll say one other thing about Pence. Because Trump had no prior experience in government and politics before becoming president, he didn't know a whole lot of people who could fill the many jobs in the executive branch that he had to fill. And in many cases, it was Mike Pence who was the source of names and suggestions, and a lot of people who are in the Trump administration, not so much in the White House, but especially in the executive departments, they're Pence people.
Let's turn to Mary now, who joins us from Pewaukee. Hi, Mary.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to say we can't forget that we must be thanking Donald Trump. One of the reasons would be all of the humor. Stephen Colbert, Saturday Night Live. What would these comedians do if we didn't have Trump as our president for the last year? Actually, many women have gotten together because of the women's marches, organizations, well, including, I would think, public television and radio, Planned Parenthood organizations have to learn new strategies to make sure that they're donations to these important organizations stand up to what they need to take care of people, human beings that have lives, and services that are helpful and required. But also that my husband has a sister in Germany, Austria actually, and a lot of other nations are looking at us as a fascist nation other than our media.
Mary, thanks so much for the call. Michael Nelson, your response.
I think it's a great observation. And again, part of the great resilience of the American constitutional system, which is now well into its third century, is that when you have a president who many people in the country don't approve of, it often inspires those opponents to take advantage of their freedom to organize and express their opposition and start building for the next election. This happened when Barack Obama was president and the Tea Party movement formed with great influence. And it's been happening during Trump's first year in all the ways that your caller just pointed out. It's a very interesting dynamic that a president who is leading on behalf of the people who elected him can have the effect of generating more grassroots activity among those who oppose what he's doing. And we've seen a lot of that over the course of the past year.
What do you think President Trump has learned from his first year in office?
He said every once in a while he has said something that confessed to, gosh. So he said, I didn't realize healthcare policy was so complicated, which is amazing because if there's one thing we know about healthcare policy, it's really complicated. He said, the job has turned out to be harder than I expected it to be. But in terms of what he's actually learned, I think certainly one thing he's learned is that what served him so well during the campaign, and that is his innovative use of social media, in particular Twitter, which he said during the campaign, you know, when I'm president, I'll probably stop doing that because it's not presidential.
Mm.
And then he got into office and could not let go of that because it's continued to be over the course of the past year a way of connecting directly, not with the country as a whole, as much as with his supporters, to kind of reinforce that core of maybe 35% of the American people who are devoted Trump supporters. And how do they get the reinforcement to stay that way? Well, they get it through social media from each other. They get it from Fox News, but they also get it from the president, whose tweets are kind of daily injections of reinforcement among those who already support him, to keep supporting. Now, I say, by the way, that he's been innovative in the use of this new media. I think it's the equivalent of Franklin Roosevelt kind of figuring out how to use radio as a leadership tool, of John F. Kennedy being the one who mastered television as a leadership tool. And whether you like what Trump has done with this leadership tool, I think he's taken for the first time this new, relatively new social media world and turned it into a device for political leadership, but in his case, leadership in the sense not of trying to broaden his base, but of reinforcing the base he's already got.
In the last minutes here of our conversation, if we could turn now to the future, can we predict anything about the remainder of President Trump's term in office based on the first year?
Well, you know, Kate, we began by talking about the fact that this first year has been remarkably crisis-free, and that the economy has been growing and the stock market's almost off the charts. It would be remarkable if a president could get through a four-year term without a recession or a serious domestic or international crisis. I mean, that's just part of the rhythm of history. So what we don't know so far is how will this president deal with a crisis. We also don't know what the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, may come up with and how close that may get to the president himself. And we don't know, and I think this is crucial, we don't know how these midterm elections are going to turn out in November, except I'll say this, they could turn out to be, I think they will turn out to be the most consequential midterm elections in history. Because if the Democrats take control of Congress this November, that is going to change the political dynamic in Washington 180 degrees because you would now have Democrats who can launch investigations, Democrats who could conceivably vote to impeach the president. I really think that what happens between now and November and what happens on Election Day in November is going to be critical for whether this president even gets to complete his four-year term, much less whether it's a successful four-year term.
As we wrap up, do you think President Trump's first year sets a precedent for future presidential norms? And how will this president be treated by political scientists, such as those at the Miller Center?
Well, one thing about Donald Trump is that he has surprised those of us who do this for a living at every turn. Nobody thought he was going to win the election, and he did. And I think we're sort of realizing that Donald Trump is in many ways very, very distinctive, even unique among anyone who's ever been in that office before. But as a scholar, I think the real added value we bring is to say, that is true, and that's true of any president. They're all different. But that if we can broaden the context and understand that he is one actor, an important actor, but one actor in a constitutional system that has 230 years under its belt and that provides lots and lots of ways of restraining a president. That, I think, is the perspective we need to hang on to.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's been my great pleasure, Kate.
Michael Nelson is the Fulmer Professor of Political Science at Rhodes College. He's also a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Miller Center and an editor of Crucible, The President's First Year, and author of Trump's First Year. This Hour of the Morning Show was produced by Brianne Shasso and Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.